It's a war between science versus religion. So said the newspaper headlines in the morning after the famous debate by Samuel Wilberforce and Thomas Huxley outside of Oxford University in England. Wilberforce's argument essentially was that if you were to find a watch lying out somewhere on the ground, and even if you did not know who created the watch, even if you did not know who built it, even if you did not see that occurring, because the chance of finding such an intricately constructed timepiece is so astronomically remote, you know that there must have been a designer by virtue of the complexity of the object. And that essentially is the argument of Paley's watchmaker. His opponent, Thomas Huxley, the renowned atheist extraordinaire, responded rather curiously. He asked for a monkey which would never die, and typewriters with infinite amounts of ink and paper. And given these two, or rather three conditions, he proposed that, given enough time, the monkey would eventually be able to type out the complete works of William Shakespeare, given enough time. And of course, the newspapers announced the next day that there is now a war between science and religion. It was all very sensational. If that was indeed the case, though, what could an average lay person of the time do? Was there any way that an average lay person could argue against the suppositions of Charles Darwin or Huxley or any of the other atheists who supported him? Most likely there would have been very little that the average person living in the 1860s could have done to argue or to refute Charles Darwin or anyone else like that. Most likely, if you were living back then, you would have no choice but to believe him implicitly. And certainly this wasn't the first time something like this had occurred. If you were to go back in time, and if you were to look at the history of science, around about the 1700s and before that, you would have encountered an idea known as spontaneous generation, which was ardently supported by all of the scientists of its day. Remember, you may not argue against these scientists if you're a layperson. You may not countermand them. You may not harbor any doubts whatsoever about the validity of their theories, because they are scientists and you are just some mere layperson. You dare not argue against them. In self-assured and arrogant tones, the atheists of that time would have told you that, well, if you can just have a little bit of mud and some water lying out in the sunlight, well, given enough time, it will surely turn into earthworms and frogs as well. Surely. Why, there can be no reasonable doubt. And of course, as every reasonable person knows, if you just had a few scraps of corn, maybe some old cloth lying somewhere in a dusty attic, why, given a little while, it will most certainly transmute itself into mice and rats. Why, there can be absolutely no doubt. And you lay people have to believe us, because we are educated. We are scientists. You dare not argue. Oh yes, and let's not forget that if you were to have a scrap of rotting meat, and if you were to leave it out, why, surely, eventually, the rotting meat will transmute itself into maggots. There can be absolutely no reasonable doubt. Especially not from lay persons who dare to argue against the suppositions of scientists like us. Nope, you would not have been able to argue with the scientists of the day had they told you any of that. You also would not have been able to argue with the scientists of your day if you lived in a day where they told you that the entire Earth is flat and that all the stars and planets orbit around it. And when you have all scientists that all agree upon a certain unifying principle like this, which you would call a paradigm, it sends all scientists researching along the same lines, and all scientists will make certain assumptions about life in the universe. It's very useful. Useful until there is a crisis, such as the crisis with geocentrism. Essentially, the problem was that, well, we have believed in this idea of the Earth being the center of the universe for so long that, well, we just can't give it up. Even though the more we learn about astronomy, the less sense it makes, even though we have to imagine orbits within orbits within orbits, for which there is absolutely no other physical basis, the theories of geocentrism became more and more and more complicated, until the scientists admitted that their theory had become a monstrosity and could predict nothing. That is very important. And around about the same time, the chemists also had something they called phlogiston theory. Phlogiston was a marvelous substance. You see, phlogiston was released during combustion. Whenever something burned, it released phlogiston. But after a while, the phlogiston theory did not quite make sense, because phlogiston began to explain everything. Causticity was caused by phlogiston. Transparency or opacity was caused by phlogiston. Everything was caused by phlogiston. But there were insurmountable problems. Because, well, say you take a candle and you put a glass bulb over it. Well, eventually what will happen is that the candle will go out. We've all seen that. But that didn't make any sense, because why? The air should be rich in phlogiston, because phlogiston is being released by the burning candle. And it became more and more and more complicated. And no one could make any kind of useful predictions based upon phlogiston theory. But a whole generation of chemists had staked their entire careers on it, and they were very, very reluctant to give it up until the crisis began to deepen. And of course, a similar pattern was observed with spontaneous generation. Louis Pasteur effectively proved that it was impossible, and many other scientists like him did similar work. But in spite of that, the idea had persisted for so many centuries. Why, even, as I recall, back to the time of the ancient Greeks, all of these centuries, scientists have believed in some kind of spontaneous generation. The idea was so prevalent that, well, we just can't give it up. It's lasted for century after century. We just can't give it up. Even many of the scientists who were, in fact, instrumental in disproving spontaneous generation, well, they didn't want to give it up. And they just had to assume that maybe at some level, in some way, spontaneous generation can occur. I mean, all these scientists for all these years can't be wrong, can they? And of course, at any given time, most of the people will believe that the scientists of their day are probably correct. Eventually, a paradigm will be overturned and it will replace itself and be replaced by another paradigm after a while, after the crisis becomes too severe. But at any given time, the lay people all assume that they have absolutely no choice but to believe the scientists. And it was the same way in the 1800s. If you were living, oh, perhaps in Europe or America back then, you would have had no choice but to believe the intellectuals who told you that all the traits of your personality, everything that affects your behavior and your belief system, all of that was determined by the shape of your skull. Now, that was called phrenology. And you would have had no choice but to believe it implicitly. You would have had no choice but to accept it. Yes, everything that you believe and feel and all your abilities are all defined by the shape of your skull. And you would not have been able to argue against an 18th century or 19th century intellectual who told you that. Now let's see, does anyone believe in any of those things today? Anyone? Show of hands? No one? I don't imagine any of those beliefs are immensely popular today. Today, instead, we have Darwin's theory of evolution. And for those who pay attention to the issue, then you will be aware that, oh, something like 90% of the scientists, they will assure the public that every single fact of biology and geology, chemistry and physics, all of it absolutely, irrefutably confirms Darwin's theory of evolution. Why, there can be absolutely no reasonable doubt. Every educated person believes it implicitly. Why, no layperson, really, can argue against it. I mean, there can be no reason to dispute it. It is an absolutely unavoidable conclusion. I suppose the only way we can really know for sure is, well, we have to analyze the scientists themselves a little bit. Is it at all possible that the scientists are being influenced by their worldview? What are the assumptions that these scientists make? Are the assumptions valid? And are the scientists as completely unbiased as they would have you believe? Are all of these scientists emotionally, intellectually pure, calculating machines that live for no other purpose than pure, absolute, objective logic? But I suppose the most important question is, as a layperson, what could you do to evaluate such a scientific claim? Is there any way you can determine whether or not a claim is really scientific, even if you do not know much about the science? Is there any kind of a cue that you could use to tell the difference between true science and between some sort of a philosophical worldview? That is perhaps the most important question. Let's briefly examine the worldview of most of these scientists who lived about the time when Darwin's theory was accepted in the late 1800s. Are there any sort of assumptions which are unverified? Was there anything that these intellectuals believed which might have made them more or less predisposed towards accepting such a theory? I'm going to examine that question with a quote or two. Here's a very illuminating quote by Aldous Huxley. I had a motive for not wanting the world to have a meaning. I consequently assumed that it had none, and I was able, without any real difficulty, to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world and is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics, he is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in a way that they find most advantageous to themselves. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. And that is from Ends and Means, page 270. And from what I've heard, that attitude was extremely prevalent amongst the intellectuals of the 19th century. Really, evolution became a means to justify the pre-existing depravity that those particular people in that segment of society had already possessed for quite some time. They already knew, somehow, that, well, no, life has absolutely no meaning. They had no evidence of this, but they all believed it anyway. And for years, they were just grasping frantically for some way, some means to justify to the general public this assumption that, well, no, life has no meaning. We can all do whatever we want and take whatever we want, and don't worry about any kind of consequences. Just get what you can and live however you like, in whatever fashion you find most personally pleasing, because there is no meaning. Having said that, let's turn to the theory of evolution. Is it really based upon rigorous logical analysis? Is it based upon irrefutable experimental scientific data? Or perhaps is it more of a hope, a faith, an ardent belief held by many atheist intellectuals? Let's look at another quote which you might also find to be extremely revealing. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. Oh, and now this one is not in the handout, incidentally. In spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for its unsubstantiated commitment to materialism, we are forced by our a priori commitment to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation. Oh, and I should also say, don't be intimidated by all of the lofty, flowery language that they use. It's basically just a tactic. And set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. And that is the main point. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. I'll say it one more time so it'll sink in. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. And that quote was made by Richard Lewontin of Harvard. And here's a very, very short and to-the-point quote which just sums up everything as clearly as can be. Even if all the evidence pointed to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. And that was made by Scott Todd, an immunologist at Kansas State University. And I think after reading a few quotes like that, which so clearly illustrate a bias, well, I think I'm going to, rather than call all these scientists doctor, I think I'm going to grant them a new title, a different title which more accurately describes their allegiance and their belief system. Oh, let's see, here's one more, Ernst Mayr. And he once said, he's quoted as saying that evolution is a simple fact. But we've already plainly seen in their own words that The scientists are going to accept evolution regardless of any data, regardless of any facts, no matter what they discover, and no matter what you tell them, and no matter what anyone else is going to discover in the future. And, well, you can see that evolution starts to become less of a rigorous science and more of a philosophy, dare I say, a faith, a deep, ardent faith. Don't think that any of these atheist scientists are not religious men. They are deeply religious and deeply faithful men. Therefore, for Ernst Mayr and his ilk, I am not going to refer to them as doctor, but rather I think they deserve another title which more accurately conveys their absolute, unswerving, religious, almost priestly devotion to the Church of Darwin. Therefore, for scientists like Ernst Mayr, I am going to refer to them as Father. Ooh, and I hope that some, if not all of you, have been watching the Evolution special, which aired on PBS last week. I certainly did. A very, well, fairly clever attempt at indoctrination, about as clever as you'd expect. But unfortunately, there are a number of highly relevant factors which they will not ever tell you on PBS. There are a number of vital pieces of information which they will never tell you on the Discovery Channel, and which they absolutely, unequivocally will never, ever tell you in school. Absolutely not. All of you are very fortunate. I'm about to make you all privileged to some very, very exclusive information. I've taken 3 college-level courses in genetics, and they never told me any of this. Never. Even though the information I'm about to give you is, well, really, it's absolutely crucial to whether or not evolution can occur. Absolutely, totally vital. But they never told me. The only reason why I know any of this is because I've had to go through the journals myself and verify a lot of the things that I've been reading. That's the only reason why I know this. I suppose, first of all, there is the problem which you might refer to as Haldane's dilemma. Father Haldane had a very illustrious career. He was a British evolutionary biologist. His career spanned decades, I think at least 50 years. He was active in the 20s. All throughout World War II, decade after decade, he was active. An ardent, religious defender and advocate of Darwin and the Darwinian faith. A true soldier. A true priest. And, well, since he's dead, I believe he died in the 70s, I am going to refer to him as Saint Haldane. Saint Haldane's most impressive accomplishment, at least in my opinion, was something that he discovered around about the late 50s, or perhaps rather something that he did not discover. Around about that time, we had figured out that DNA was a hereditary molecule. We could not do much with it, not really, but we could look at it, and we could count it, and we could quantitatively verify some parts of it, and we could do a few preliminary studies. Remember, what I'm about to tell you is very privileged information. You will never ever hear this on school or on TV. Never. And geneticists will never admit this to you. You'll have to pin them down and strangle them and beat them before you can get them to admit to this. They will never tell you on their own. Well, let's see, the problem essentially is that within any human cell, you have enough DNA which basically constitutes 2.9 billion base pairs. Think of a base pair as, well, it spells out a chemical letter. Think of it that way, like chemical letters. And you can think of these chemical letters as being basically part of a word. And now some words are bigger than others, and there is not really necessarily a one base pair, one gene correlation. That's rare. It's very, very complicated, immensely complicated. But essentially, you can think of it as being chemical letters which spell out words which are translated, transcribed, and then translated. That's basically the best way to think of it. Now, we've got a problem. 2.9 billion base pairs. They found that out. And Saint Haldane, he wanted to figure out, well, how fast can evolution occur? How quickly can it act? On average, how long would it take? How many generations would it take? To that end, he began studying and doing a few basic investigations on the chimpanzee genome. and many other creatures too. And essentially, chimpanzees, well, they basically have the same number that we do, as far as I know, 2.9 billion, about the same number. And as you might have heard, the tests indicate that humans and chimpanzees are anywhere from 1 to 3% difference. You can round that out to 2% difference. A 2% genetic difference between you and some chimpanzee, so the tests say. But, well, 2% is, in some cases, a rather significant number. 2%, a 2% difference, if you were, say, an airline pilot, could make the difference between Europe and Africa when you're doing your calculations. In the business world, a 2% difference in productivity could make the difference between millions of dollars. And in genetics, the case is somewhat similar. Of course, evolutionists will jump on this 2%. Why, they're so similar. Why, they must have evolved from some common ancestor as us. Why, the differences are so slight. Why, there can be no reasonable doubt. Why, you cannot dispute the fact. It is absolutely, completely true. And you dare not argue with us, because we are scientists. And it really does matter, especially in this particular case. Because really, well, 2% of 2.9 billion, you can get out your calculator, and with your calculator you can do this, it turns into a number on the order of 60 million. Somehow, some way, there must have been at least 60 million genetic transformations somewhere back there. Somewhere, 60 million of our chemical letters must have changed themselves in a precise, coordinated way, which gave our hypothetical ape ancestors some kind of an advantage. Well, St. Haldane, he had to calculate how fast mutations occur. And mutation, of course, we know that these are coding errors. They are mistakes made when genes copy themselves, when you're growing, or maybe when your cells are dividing, copying errors. And so he had to figure out, well, how often do mutations occur? And if a mutation gave some hypothetical ape an advantage, how long would it take for that advantageous gene to completely take over a population? How long? And St. Haldane took into consideration whether genes are dominant or recessive, and how often they occur, and the size of the population. He took into consideration a wide variety of factors, and he generated a huge, massive amount of data. On average, he kept coming back to a number of 300 generations. Most likely, it would take 300 generations for some possibly beneficial mutant gene to spread all the way throughout a population. Because, of course, an organism that has an advantage, well, it has to reproduce more often than everyone else in the population. It has to leave behind more offspring, so that eventually its own genes will remain and take over, and that the genes which do not carry that advantage will die out. So that advantageous gene, in theory, would spread throughout the population. On average, he kept coming back to a number of 300 generations. Oh, and to clarify a little bit, as I said, mutations are copying errors, and, well, your genes are copying themselves all the time, constantly copying. And every once in a while, a mistake will happen. The only mistakes that are really relevant are the mistakes that happen in your reproductive cells, which can be passed on to the next generation. Those are the only ones that really matter. And as I recall, the rate of errors, it's something like, oh boy, 1 in 10 million replications. It's unbelievably low. Far, far better than almost any human editor could ever hope to accomplish. And because we have, inside of our cells, we have editing mechanisms in our cells, we have error correction machinery. We really do. I had to study it for quite some time over the summer. It was very difficult. Immensely elaborate, immensely complex system that reads all of your DNA and checks it for errors, and has the ability to cut out and replace defective genes. It's immensely complex and very, very elaborate, and far better than a human editor. And that brings us to the problem. Let's say you have some population of mammals, maybe a little bit like us, or perhaps maybe they are a population of super chimpanzees or pre-chimpanzees, and they are evolving their way towards humanity. Gradually, slowly, they are beginning the lengthy evolutionary journey that they all obsess over on the Discovery Channel and on PBS and on all those shows. They are beginning that journey. Here's a problem, though. Remember, it takes 300 generations for one beneficial mutation to take over most populations. You really can't seem to easily get around that number. Okay, you've got a super chimpanzee, and he gets a mutation. Let's say he has a 1% advantage. He can leave, on average, 1% more offspring. That really is fairly high. Most mutations only give you a fraction of that. Even the good ones, if any mutation could be called good. He has, let's say, a 1% advantage. He's a super chimpanzee. Somehow, this lucky chimpanzee, well, he's got to stop every other chimpanzee in the population from reproducing. He's got to spread his own genes, and somehow he's got to take over. He's got to. Because if he does not, then his genes will become diluted. And, well, it becomes something of a problem. If they were anything like us, then these super chimpanzees would probably take from between, say, 10 to 20 years before they would be able to reproduce again. If they were anything like us. And, well, mathematically, the problem soon becomes evident. On average, it can take 300 generations for any kind of an advantageous new gene to take over the population. Now, if you're like us and you have to reproduce, you have to wait maybe 10 or 20 years before you reproduce, well, with 20 years and 300 generations, that becomes a problem. Because remember, it takes, somehow or another, to transform a chimpanzee to a human, you must make 60 million changes. Somehow, there must be 60 million genes which somehow give an advantage, and they must somehow be transformed, some way or another. In order for this to work, I spent some time working all this out. The lucky super chimpanzee, he has to keep everyone else in his group from reproducing, somehow or another. He must find a female chimpanzee with exactly the same mutation. Somehow all the others have to die in some way. But then, the problem is, though, the evolutionists will assure us that, well, based on the fossil evidence, although now they change it, they used to say it took 10 million years for our ancestors to go from the common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees into humans. They used to say it took 10 million years, but now they have some molecular evidence and they think it took 5 million years, but that really doesn't so much matter. But, okay, let's say that in 5 million years, you want to turn a chimpanzee into a human, let's just say. Somehow, you've got to generate 240 new genes every generation. About every 20 years, somehow, you've got to create 240 new genes. Every one of them must give you an advantage. They all must form a perfect, coordinated package. And at the end of this generation, after all of these mutants have taken over, all of them have to die, and somehow another mutant has to build up another 240 brand new, never-before-seen genes, which will somehow give them an advantage and keep all the others from reproducing. And you have to do this, because if you don't do this, if the chimpanzee doesn't do this, his genes will become diluted, and the process will drag out on and on and on, and it might never happen. And if we assume that, well, it took 5 million years to make a human being, then you've got to have 240 new genes appearing every 20 years. Now, you don't really have to be a geneticist to realize that this is just a little bit odd. I mean, does anyone believe that we are seeing anywhere in the world any situation where 240 brand new coordinated genes are appearing in one generation? Does that ever happen? Well, no. No one has ever seen anything remotely like that, or anything remotely close to that, ever. Based on everything we see going around us today, well, a billion years would not be enough for such a transformation. It would take millions upon millions upon hundreds of millions of years, based on everything we see today, in order to change this, in order to create that level of genetic change. A billion years is not enough time. And you can pretty easily see how absurd it becomes. If when you do the math, a billion years is not really long enough to change a chimpanzee into a human. Well, what about some of the other gaps? What about the gap between, well, birds and reptiles, or reptiles and mammals, or fish to frogs? What about those gaps? Many times they are even larger than 2%. Well, how long would that take? That's a question that, well, really, no one ever likes to talk about. It might take on the order of 360 billion years for a chimpanzee to turn itself into a human being based upon all the changes that we see today. And, well, no, you don't have to be a geneticist to see that this is becoming more than a little absurd. Here's something to remember. This is basically a take-home message. You really cannot accept any kind of a scientific idea, theory like this, unless there is a valid mechanism. Unless someone can show me, you can tell I'm from Missouri, show me how you can get 60 million genetic transformations in that length of time, well, you really can't believe it. You cannot believe a scientific theory unless there is a valid mechanism. If there is no mechanism for what they're talking about, we have to look for another explanation. That's one of the things you look for. You can't just believe something just because a scientist says it if he cannot really produce any kind of valid numbers and valid figures. But wait! It must be irrefutable! We're so much like the chimpanzees. Why, we just can't deny it! It's absolutely, completely irrefutable, say the atheist geneticists. Well, let's see. Now, remember spontaneous generation? Now, here's another example. Explorers back in the 19th and 18th centuries would go into the African jungles for a variety of reasons. Many times, while they're in these jungles and environments, the European explorers would catch a wide variety of horrible diseases. Sometimes they would come back with these horrible tapeworms in their bodies. And this was rather surprising. I mean, everyone knows that an explorer in a foreign land, he's not going to find a strange wriggling worm and swallow it willingly. Probably not, almost certainly not. But no one would go around swallowing these horrible wriggling parasitic worms willingly, but, well darn it, they would show up in people. Well, that obviously proves that, well, if you go into certain environments, it creates the right conditions for these tapeworms to spontaneously transmute themselves and appear inside of your stomach. Why, it's an absolute irrefutable conclusion, and it was used to support the idea of spontaneous generation. I mean, how can you argue with it? I mean, there's the evidence. Why, it must be true. It absolutely must be true. And you cannot argue with us scientists. Lay people cannot argue with us, and they cannot dispute us. But unless someone can explain and reproduce the mechanism by which you can spontaneously create a tapeworm, really, you are not obligated to believe it. You must have a mechanism, absolutely. You just cannot take anything on faith the way they are doing increasingly in the natural sciences when it comes to evolution. Oh boy, let's see. Well, how many evidences are there which would support perhaps some kind of a creation? Here is an example which they did discuss this briefly in PBS. My teachers tried to explain it to me, but they dropped the ball miserably. They did a miserable job of trying to justify this. I like to call this the homeobox paradox. And before I tell you what a homeotic gene is, I first need to tell you a little bit of a story by way of analogy. Well, let's imagine that we have a school. I guess it could be a high school. Let's say that we have four brothers, let's just say. And these four brothers are in different grades, and they are in different classes, and they have different teachers. All four of the brothers are given an assignment. It's a different assignment for each brother. One brother, he has to give a book report. The other one has to write a social studies paper. One brother has to write a history paper, and another brother has to write an English paper. Well, it's interesting because all four of these brothers, with different teachers, with different assignments, who are in different grades, they all come up with exactly the same paper. They turn in to their four respective teachers exactly the same paper written word for word. Eventually, the teachers discover this, and they are a bit upset. They call all the brothers into the office and make them explain themselves. Why did you collaborate when you wrote these papers, they said. Did you think you would get away with this? And the brothers insist, oh no, no, we didn't collaborate. There was no deliberate, intelligent design or intelligent collaboration in any of this. You see, we're brothers. We all came from the same place. Therefore, well, since we're brothers and we sort of think alike, all four of us, even though we had completely different teachers, even though we had different assignments, and even though we are in different grades, we all just naturally thought to write exactly the same paper, word for word. All of us just naturally did exactly the same thing for these four different assignments, for these four different teachers. Because we're brothers, and we're a lot like each other. So we all wrote exactly the same paper, word for word, just through pure accident. Well, would most teachers be likely to believe a story like that? Well, I suppose an evolutionary biologist would probably have to believe it. In the past couple of years, we've discovered, well, they actually did mention this on PBS, we have discovered that there are a small body of genes which are called homeotic genes. These genes are like switches that control gross anatomy. There is a homeotic gene which tells your legs to start growing. It does not really create your legs. It just tells other genes where to put your legs. The homeotic gene controls where your legs are. Another homeotic gene controls where your arms are. Another homeotic gene tells where your eyes will be and how many eyes you will have. And there are homeotic genes that control your ears and nose and mouth. They control gross anatomy. They are like switches. Here's something I found which was very fascinating, and they never told me this in school. I had to dig this up myself by looking through some technical documents. Well, let's say that you've got two organisms. You've got an elephant, and you've got a millipede. Let's say you have an elephant embryo, and let's say you want to be really cool, and you want to perform some really weird experiments. So, you use your genetic techniques. You find the homeotic gene, which activates leg growth in an elephant. If you wanted to, you could disable the gene, or maybe cut it out, but it'd be easier to disable it. You turn off the gene which tells an elephant embryo to start growing legs. You turn off that gene totally. And then let's say you have the millipede. Yeah, say you have a millipede, an embryo of a millipede. And, well, here's what you could do. If you can find the homeotic gene that activates leg growth in a millipede, you could cut out that gene. You could put it into an elephant embryo. And that elephant, he will grow normal elephant legs in the normal place that elephants should grow their legs, if you get it right. The exact same genetic switch activates leg growth in elephants and insects, as it turns out. I found this especially fascinating because, well, think about this. Think about the leg of any insect. I mean, it's segmented. And the insect leg is constructed with a totally different set of physical principles in a totally different way. It's got muscles at the joints, and it's totally different from the way your legs work with muscles wrapped around bones. Completely different. The legs of mammals and insects are totally different. Now, if we were to go back into evolutionary history, the common ancestor of mammals and insects, it would have to be some kind of a little tiny wriggling worm wriggling around in some primordial soup. Now, this wriggling worm, which has to be the common ancestor of all mammals and then of insects, it would not have had legs on its own. It almost certainly would not. So, let's say there's a lot of the wriggling worms, and they become separated. Some of them begin to mutate, and they evolve into the animals which will someday have backbones. And in another branch, they get separated, and they evolve into the organisms which will someday be insects. Well, both of them, they've got to get legs somehow. Through a totally different set of mutations, they end up with exactly the same homeotic switch which codes for leg growth. Now, it doesn't make sense to call this common ancestry. That's what evolutionists always say. Well, it was common ancestry. That's why they have the same genes. But that doesn't make sense, because insects would have to have evolved their legs separately. They must have. It must have been a totally different string of mutations. And you can see that. The legs of an insect there's a totally, well, the genes which actually build the leg of an insect, they are in a different place than the genes for a mammal's legs. And a totally different tissue gives rise to insect legs as opposed to the tissue that gives rise to legs in animals with backbones. Totally different tissue, and the genes are a little bit different. But there are some genes, the homeotic genes, the control switches, which for some reason are exactly the same. But that does not make sense. They must have arisen in a different way. If evolution is true, they must have arisen through a totally different set of mutations. The common ancestor would not have had legs. How is it at all possible that somehow they would duplicate exactly the same control gene, which works and causes exactly the same effect? It activates legs. Evolution is supposed to be a random process. There is not supposed to be any kind of a guiding, ordering principle. It's supposed to be totally random. All of it is totally accidental, totally serendipitous. But it's not just legs that you see this. You see this with eyes. There's a battery of homeotic genes which activate eye growth. But there are perhaps 40 different kinds of eyes that animals can have. Somehow, all these eyes, which must have arose, evolved through different pathways, they've all got the same gene which activates them. It's rather surprising. I never would have predicted something like that. And here's, I think, an even more fascinating example. They did a study on baby chicks and on fruit flies a while ago. Turns out that in a baby chick, the gene which activates the growth of the baby chick's wings turns out to be the same gene which activates wing growth in a fruit fly. Now that blew me away. Think about the wing of a bird. It's like an arm, a lot like our arms. According to the evolutionary story, birds must have evolved from some kind of a reptile way, way back in the age of the dinosaurs. Therefore, you'd think that the genes which coded and activated wing growth in a bird, you'd think they would be the same genes which activated leg growth in some kind of reptile. But no! The genes which activate wing growth in a baby chick are the same as the genes which activate wing growth in a fruit fly. Think about a fly. Think about its wings. Totally different construction. They work in accordance with a totally different set of physical principles. They are not in the slightest bit related. They come from a totally different type of body tissue. The only thing they have in common is, of course, the fact that both are used for flying. But it's a different kind of flight. They must have arisen through different, a totally different, totally independent set of mutations. Yet somehow, the control switch is the same. I mean, it's almost as if some kind of a far-reaching intelligence almost orchestrated. But no. That conclusion is, of course, completely and totally unacceptable. You know, remember Father Scott Todd. Even if all the evidence points to an intelligent designer, we can't acknowledge it because we have our bias. And of course, as I said earlier, my teachers just totally botched the issue. Their explanation was ridiculous. Really, I was embarrassed for them to hear how ridiculous it was. It was pathetic. Oh, also, one other thing about the homeotic genes that you should know. They tried to claim on PBS that basically that the homeotic genes, that they control the evolution of your body plan, of the way your body is structured. Why, who knew evolution would be so easy, said one of the geneticists. What they are not telling you is that, as it turns out, there have been absolutely no homeotic mutations that have ever, ever been successful. Ever since we've been studying them, none of them have ever been successful. You can get all kinds of flies with legs growing out of their heads. You might get maybe some kind of frogs or worms with eyes all over their bodies. All kinds of freakish horrors you can get by tampering with homeotic genes. But there has never been a homeotic mutation which was not lethal. All these mutants are horrible, deformed cripples. It seems like any kind of a change to the homeotic gene will totally, completely destroy any chance the organism had to survive. That's not always true with normal genes. But it's interesting, with these homeotic genes, none of the mutations anyone has ever seen have ever been useful for anything except as horrible laboratory curiosities. rather fascinating, but they'll never tell you that in PBS. Never, ever tell you that. And they did not want... Well, let's see. Moving on to another example. Once again, I'm about to make you party to some very, very privileged information. Information which I never learned. They never told me this in school. It is absolutely vital to whether or not evolution could occur. It's time that I reveal to you another dirty little secret of population genetics. I guess this one is perhaps even more damaging than St. Haldane's dilemma. And it's even more troubling, too. Really, it's almost a health problem, but we don't have to worry about that for a long time, though. In short, the problem is this. It is a problem of what you might call mutation load. According to the evolutionary story, when you have a population of animals, some of them will mutate. Now, research has confirmed that 99.9% of the mutations are either neutral or harmful. But there is that 0.1%, and that 0.1% of mutations will give you an advantage. And the lucky organism that has this genetic advantage, he will take over the population, and the population will evolve, and they will change over time. Not all mutations are like this. Not all mutations are good. Most of them are harmful. But the lucky organism that gets the 0.1% of mutations that are beneficial, he will prosper and he will thrive and he will take over the population. That is how the story goes. The reality, well, there is one horrible, horrible problem which no one ever talks about. The problem is with those 99.9% of the other mutations. You see, no one likes to talk about these mutations, but the problem is, these mutations are not going to go away. They never mention that, but it's true. Anyone here have arthritis? Does anyone know anyone who was born with diabetes? Any kind of a congenital medical disorder? I'm sure there must be someone in the audience, yeah, who has something like that. Congenital disorders and diseases like that, and, well, arthritis, it is basically a result of some kinds of mutation. Disorders like this are basically a result of genes which, for some reason, have persisted in spite of, so they tell us, millions of years of glorious natural selection. But why don't those genes go away? Why don't they? There's no reason why they should go away. They will remain, and they will persist. And a few brave scientists have worked this out. You might get maybe one mutation, which perhaps might provide you with some kind of a minor selective benefit. If you do, on average, you will accumulate 1,000, which have the potential to hurt you. 1,000. Every time you maybe get one mutation, which under some narrow circumstances might do you some good, you have the potential to build up 1,000, which are harmful. Of course, the worst mutations, they will disappear right away. The really, really incredibly gross and damaging mutations, they will disappear instantly because the organism will not survive. But ultimately, it becomes a case of death by 1,000 cuts. Oh, maybe just a minor decrease in the efficiency of one gene, maybe a minor decrease in the efficiency of eyesight. Nothing very dramatic, but over time, you begin to have a problem. I have horrible news for all of you who are listening to this. We, the human race, are not going to evolve into any kind of superior life form. They may tell you this on Star Trek, but we are not going to evolve into an advanced, superior form of creature. We are not going to improve ourselves at all. We are going to accumulate mutations, and these mutations will hurt us. And there is no way to get rid of these mutations. They will build up and build up like tartar in an unbrushed mouth. Far from evolving to anything superior, eventually we are going to die. That's right, the human race and all species are going to die. It is just that simple. You cannot get rid of the mutations, and they will eventually build up, and you will, all of us, eventually, the human race will die.
We are not evolving into a perfect creature, as you can see. And these are all things that science is not telling you. The creature started, including mankind, at a more perfect level, and it's been going down. Not the opposite of what evolutionists would like us to believe, that we're getting better and more perfect. We may have better nutrition thanks to science, but that's not that we're evolving into better organisms. I hope you enjoyed the Intelligent Design program. Satire is used in certain places to emphasize some of the absurdities and attitudes of many in the scientific community, sort of like Elijah used it. A war does continue to rage in our educational systems, which until now the atheists have been winning. So-called watchdog organizations have one purpose: to ensure that only evolution is taught in public schools. And if we had true academic atmosphere, both theories would be taught. But obviously, intelligent design would so outshine evolution if they taught both that people would ask the question, wow, what a designer. And the fact that they only teach evolution in public schools, this is the equivalent of political correctness for the science education community. Rather than promoting science education, as its name implies, the true agenda is to make sure that intelligent design is kept out of the classroom. And I, Dr. James Ricks, would like to add, personally, take a look at any piece of anatomy, you know, on the wall of your doctor's office. I was just recently saw one of the skeletal muscular nervous system in the spine. If you take a look at such a design and such a drawing, I would say, take a look at that and then tell me there is no intelligent design. It's impossible to do that. Or go to your eye doctor and look at a detailed eye chart, and you'll be impressed by the wonderful design of a genius designer. Thank you, and hope we've given you a lot of scientific and background information to consider.